slung over one forearm. Then an idiot on a Yamaha roared past me, missing my front bumper by a few scant inches. He wore a denim jacket, mirror sunglasses, and no helmet. "Look at that stupid shit," Norton growled. I circled the parking lot once, looking for a good space. There were none. I was just resigning myself to a long walk from the far end of the lot when I got lucky. A lime-green Cadillac the size of a small cabin cruiser was easing out of a slot in the rank closest to the market stores. The moment it was gone, I slid into the space. I gave Billy Steph's shopping list. He was 5, but he could read printing. "Get a cart and get started. I want to give your mother a jingle. Mr. Norton will help you, and I'll be right along." We got out, and Billy immediately grabbed Mr. Norton's hand. He'd been taught not to cross the parking lot without holding an adult's hand when he was younger and hadn't yet lost the habit. Norton looked surprised for a moment, and then smiled a little. I could almost forgive him for feeling Steph up with his eyes. The two of them went into the market. I strolled over to the payphone, which was on the wall between the drugstore and the Norge. A sweltering woman in a purple sunsuit was jogging the cutoff switch up and down. I stood behind her with my hands in my pockets, wondering why I felt so uneasy about Steph, and why the unease should be all wrapped up with that line of white but unsparkling fog, the radio stations that were off the air, and the Arrowhead Project. The woman in the purple sunsuit had a sunburn and freckles on her fat shoulders. She looked like a sweaty orange baby. She slammed the phone back down in its cradle, turned toward the drugstore, and saw me there. "Save your dime," she said. "Just da-da-da." She walked grumpily away. I almost slapped my forehead. The phone lines were down someplace, of course. Some of them were underground, but nowhere near all of them. I tried the phone anyway. The payphones in the area are what Steph calls paranoid payphones. Instead of putting your dime right in, you get a dial tone and make your call. When someone answers, there's an automatic cutoff, and you have to shove your dime in before your party hangs up. They're irritating, but that day it did save me my dime. There was no dial tone. As the lady had said, it was just da, da, da. I hung up and walked slowly toward the market, just in time to see an amusing little incident. An elderly couple walked toward the inn door, chatting together. And still chatting, they walked right into it. They stopped talking in a jangle, and the woman squawked her surprise. They stared at each other comically. Then they laughed, and the old guy pushed the door open for his wife with some effort. Those electric eye doors are heavy, and they went in. When the electricity goes off, it catches you in 100 different ways. I pushed the door open myself and noticed the lack of air conditioning first thing. Usually in the summer, they have it cranked up high enough to give you frostbite if you stay in the market more than an hour at a stretch. Like most modern markets, the Federal was constructed like a Skinner box. Modern marketing techniques turn all customers into white rats. The stuff you really needed, staples like bread, milk, meat, beer, and frozen dinners, was all on the far side of the store. To get there, you had to walk past all the impulse items known to modern man, everything from cricket lighters to rubber dog bones. Beyond the inn door is the fruit and vegetable aisle. I looked up it, but there was no sign of Norton or my son. The old lady who had run into the door was examining the grapefruits. Her husband had produced a net sack to store purchases in. I walked up the aisle and went left. I found them, in the third aisle, Billy mulling over the ranks of Jell-O packages and instant puddings. Norton was standing directly behind him, peering at Steph's list. I had to grin a little at his nonplussed expression. I threaded my way down to them, past half-loaded carriages. Steph hadn't been the only one struck by the squirreling impulse, apparently. And browsing shoppers. Norton took 2 cans of pie filling down from the top shelf and put them in the cart. "How are you doing?" I asked, and Norton looked around with unmistakable relief.
"All right, aren't we, Billy?"
"Sure," Billy said, and couldn't resist adding in a rather smug tone. "But there's lots of stuff Mr. Norton can't read either, Dad."
"Let me see." I took the list.
Norton had made a neat, lawyerly check beside each of the items he and Billy had picked up,
half a dozen or so, including the milk and a six-pack of Coke. There were maybe 10 other things that she wanted. "We ought to go back to the fruits and vegetables," I said. "She wants some tomatoes and cucumbers." Billy started to turn the cart around, and Norton said, "You ought to go have a look at the checkout, Dave."
I went and had a look. It was the sort of thing you sometimes see photos of in the paper on a slow news day with a humorous caption beneath. Only two lanes were open, and the double line of people waiting to check their purchases out stretched past the mostly denuded bread racks, then made a jig to the right and went out of sight along the frozen food coolers. All of the new computerized NCRs were hooded. At each of the two open positions, a harried-looking girl was tidying up purchases on a battery-powered pocket calculator. Standing with each girl was one of the Federal's two managers, Bud Brown and Ollie Weeks. I liked Ollie, but didn't care much for Bud Brown, who seemed to fancy himself the Charles de Gaulle of the supermarket world. As each girl finished checking her order, Bud or Ollie would paperclip a chit to the customer's cash or check and toss it into the box he was using as a cash repository. They all looked hot and tired.
"Hope you brought a good book," Norton said, joining me. "We're going to be in line for a while."
I thought of Steph again, at home alone, and had another flash of unease.
"You go on and get your stuff," I said. "Billy and I can handle the rest of this.
Want me to grab a few more beers for you too?"
I thought about it, but in spite of the rapprochement, I didn't want to spend the afternoon with Brent Norton getting drunk, not with the mess things went around the house.
"Sorry," I said. "I've got to take a rain check, Brent."
I thought his face stiffened a little.
"Okay," he said shortly and walked off.
I watched him go, and then Billy was tugging at my shirt.
"Did you talk to Mommy?"
"Nope. The phone wasn't working. Those lines are down too, I guess."
"Are you worried about her?"
"No," I said, lying. I was worried, all right, but had no idea why I should be.
"No, of course I'm not. Are you?"
"No." But he was. His face had a pinched look. We should have gone back then, but even then, it might have been too late.
3. The Coming of the Mist. We worked our way back to the fruits and vegetables like salmon fighting their way upstream. I saw some familiar faces. Mike Hatlin, one of our selectmen. Mrs. Repler from the grammar school, she who had terrified generations of third graders, was currently sneering at the cantaloupes. Mrs. Terman, who sometimes sat Billy when Steph and I went out. But mostly, they were summer people stocking up on no-cook items and joshing each other about roughing it. The cold cuts had been picked over as thoroughly as the dime book tray at a rummage sale. There was nothing left but a few packages of bologna, some macaroni loaf, and one lonely phallic kielbasa sausage. I got tomatoes, cukes, and a jar of mayonnaise. She wanted bacon, but all the bacon was gone. I picked up some of the bologna as a substitute, although I've never been able to eat the stuff with any real enthusiasm since the FDA reported that each package contained a small amount of insect filth. A little something extra for your money.
"Look," Billy said as we rounded the corner to the fourth aisle. "There's some army guys."
There were two of them, their dun uniforms standing out against the much brighter background of summer clothes and sportswear. We had gotten used to seeing a scattering of army personnel with the Arrowhead Project only 30 miles or so away. These two looked hardly old enough to shave yet. I glanced back down at Steph's list and saw that we had everything. No, almost, but not quite. At the bottom, as an afterthought, she had scribbled, "Bottle of Lancers." That sounded good to me. A couple of glasses of wine tonight after Billy had sacked out, and maybe a long, slow bout of lovemaking before sleep. I left the cart and worked my way down to the wine and got a bottle. As I walked back, I passed the big double doors leading to the storage area and heard the steady roar of a good-sized generator. I decided it was probably just big enough to keep the cold cases cold, but not large enough to power the doors and cash registers and all the other electrical equipment. It sounded like a motorcycle back there. Norton appeared just as we got into line, balancing 2 6-packs of Schlitz Light, a loaf of bread, and the kielbasa I had spotted a few minutes earlier. He got in line with Billy and me. It seemed very warm in the market with the air conditioning off, and I wondered why none of the stock boys had at least chocked the doors open. I'd seen Buddy Eagleton in his red apron 2 aisles back, doing nothing and piling it up. The generator roared monotonously. I had the beginnings of a headache. "Put your stuff in here before you drop something," I said.
"Thanks."
The lines were up past the frozen food now. People had to cut through to get what they wanted, and there was much excuse-me-ing and pardon-me-ing.
"This is going to be a cunt," Norton said morosely, and I frowned a little. That sort of language is rougher than I'd like Billy to hear.
The generator's roar muted a little as the line shuffled forward. Norton and I made desultory conversation, skirting around the ugly property dispute that had landed us in district court and sticking with things like the Red Sox's chances and the weather. At last we exhausted our little store of small talk and fell silent. Billy fidgeted beside me. The line crawled along. Now we had frozen dinners on our right and the more expensive wines and champagnes on our left. As the line progressed down to the cheaper wines, I toyed briefly with the idea of picking up a bottle of Ripple, the wine of my flaming youth. I didn't do it. My youth never flamed that much, anyway.
"Jeez, why can't they hurry up, Dad?"
Billy asked. That pinched look was still on his face, and suddenly, briefly, the mist of disquiet that had settled over me rifted, and something terrible peered through from the other side. The bright and metallic face of terror. Then it passed. "Keep cool, champ," I said. We had made it up to the bread racks, to the point where the double line bent to the left. We could see the checkout lanes now, the 2 that were open and the other 4 deserted, each with a little sign on the stationary conveyor belt, signs that read, "Please choose another lane," and "Winston." Beyond the lanes was the big sectioned plate glass window, which gave a view of the parking lot and the intersection of routes 117 and 302 beyond. The view was partially obscured by the white paper backs of signs advertising current specials and the latest giveaway, which happened to be a set of books called The Mother Nature Encyclopedia. We were in the line that would eventually lead us to the checkout where Bud Brown was standing. There were still maybe 30 people in front of us. The easiest one to pick out was Mrs. Carmody in her blazing yellow pantsuit. She looked like an advertisement for yellow fever. Suddenly, a shrieking noise began in the distance. It quickly built up in volume and resolved itself into the crazy warble of a police siren. A horn blared at the intersection, and there was a shriek of brakes and burning rubber. I couldn't see. The angle was all wrong, but the siren reached its loudest as it approached the market and then began to fade as the police car went past. A few people broke out of line to look, but not many. They had waited too long to chance losing their places. Norton went. His stuff was tucked into my cart. After a few moments, he came back and got into line again.
"Local fuzz," he said.
Then the town fire whistle began to wail, slowly cranking up to a shriek of its own, falling off, then rising again. Billy grabbed my hand, clutched it.
"What is it, Daddy?"
he asked, and then immediately,
"Is Mommy all right?"
"Must be a fire on the Kansas Road," Norton said. "Those damned live lines from the storm. The fire trucks will go through in a minute."
That gave my disquiet something to crystallize on. There were live lines down in our yard. Bud Brown said something to the checker he was supervising. She had been craning around to see what was happening. She flushed and began to run her calculator again. I didn't want to be in this line. All of a sudden, I very badly didn't want to be in it. But it was moving again, and it seemed foolish to leave now. We had gotten down by the cartons of cigarettes. Someone pushed through the end door. Some teenager. I think it was the kid we almost hit coming in, the one on the Yamaha with no helmet.
"The fog!" he yelled. "You ought to see the fog! It's rolling right up Kansas Road!
People looked around at him. He was panting, as if he had run a long distance. Nobody said anything.
Well, you ought to see it,
he repeated, sounding defensive this time. People eyed him, and some of them shuffled, but no one wanted to lose his or her place in line. A few people who hadn't reached the lines yet left their carts and strolled through the empty checkout lanes to see if they could see what he was talking about. A big guy in a summer hat with a paisley band, the kind of hat you almost never see except in beer commercials with backyard barbecues as their settings, yanked open the outdoor, and several people, 10, maybe a dozen, went out with him. The kid went along.
Don't let out all the air conditioning,
one of the army kids cracked, and there were a few chuckles. I wasn't chuckling. I had seen the mist coming across the lake.
Billy, why don't you go have a look? Norton said.
No, I said at once, for no concrete reason. The line moved forward again. People craned their necks, looking for the fog the kid had mentioned. But there was nothing on view except bright blue sky. I heard someone say that the kid must have been joking. Someone else responded that he had seen a funny line of mist on Long Lake not an hour ago. The first whistle whooped and screamed. I didn't like it. It sounded like big league doom blowing that way. More people went out. A few even left their places in line, which speeded up the proceedings a bit. Then grizzled old John Lee Froven, who works as a mechanic at the Texaco station, came ducking in and yelled,
Hey, anybody got a camera?
He looked around, then ducked back out again. That caused something of a rush. If it was worth taking a picture of, it was worth seeing. Suddenly, Mrs. Carmody cried in her rusty but powerful old voice, Don't go out there! People turned around to look at her. The orderly shape of the lines had grown fuzzy as people left to get a look at the mist, or as they drew away from Mrs. Carmody, or as they milled around seeking out their friends. A pretty young woman in a cranberry-colored sweatshirt and dark green slacks was looking at Mrs. Carmody in a thoughtful, evaluating way. A few opportunists were taking advantage of whatever the situation was to move up a couple of places. The checker beside Bud Brown looked over her shoulder again, and Brown tapped her shoulder with a long finger.
Keep your mind on what you're doing, Sally.
Don't go out there,
Mrs. Carmody yelled.
It's death. I feel that it's death out there.
Bud and Ollie Weeks, who both knew her, just looked impatient and irritated. But any summer people around her stepped smartly away, never minding their places in line. The bag ladies in big cities seemed to have the same effect on people as if they were carriers of some contagious disease. Who knows? Maybe they are. Things began to happen at an accelerating, confusing pace then.
A man staggered into the market, shoving the inn door open. His nose was bleeding.
Something in the fog!
He screamed, and Billy shrank against me, whether because of the man's bloody nose or what he was saying, I don't know.
Something in the fog! Something in the fog took John Lee! Something!
He staggered back against the display of lawn food stacked by the window and sat down there.
Something in the fog took John Lee! And I heard him screaming!
The situation changed. Made nervous by the storm, by the police siren and the fire whistle, by the subtle dislocation any power outage causes in the American psyche, and by the steadily mounting atmosphere of unease as things somehow changed. I don't know how to put it any better than that. People began to move in a body. They didn't bolt. If I told you that, I would be giving you entirely the wrong impression. It wasn't exactly a panic. They didn't run, or at least most of them didn't. But they went. Some of them just went to the big show window on the far side of the checkout lanes to look out. Others went out the inn door, some still carrying their intended purchases. Bud Brown, harried and officious, began yelling,
Hey! You haven't paid for that! Hey, you! Come back here with those hot dog rolls!
Someone laughed at him, a crazy yodeling sound that made other people smile. Even as they smiled, they looked bewildered, confused, and nervous. Then someone else laughed, and Brown flushed. He grabbed a box of mushrooms away from a lady who was crowding past him to look out the window. The segments of glass were lined with people now. They were like the folks you see looking through loopholes into a building site, and the lady screamed, "Give me back my mushies!" This bizarre term of affection caused two men standing nearby to break into crazy laughter, and there was something of the old English bedlam about all of it now. Mrs. Carmody trumpeted again not to go out there. The fire whistle whooped breathlessly, a strong old woman who had scared up a prowler in the house, and Billy burst into tears.
"Daddy, what's that bloody man? Why is that bloody man?"
"It's okay, Big Bill. It's his nose. He's okay."
"What did he mean, something in the fog?" Norton asked. He was frowning ponderously, which was probably Norton's way of looking confused.
"Daddy, I'm scared,"
Billy said through his tears.
"Can we please go home?"
Someone bumped past me, roughly jolting me off my feet, and I picked Billy up. I was getting scared, too. The confusion was mounting. Sally, the checker by Bud Brown, started away, and he grabbed her back by the collar of her red smock. It ripped. She slap-clawed out at him, her face twisting.
"Get your fucking hands off me!" she screamed.
"Oh, shut up, you little bitch," Brown said, but he sounded totally astounded.
He reached for her again, and Ollie Weeks said sharply, "Bud, cool it." Someone else screamed. It hadn't been a panic before, not quite, but it was getting to be one. People streamed out of both doors. There was a crash of breaking glass, and coke fizzed suddenly across the floor.
"What the Christ is this?" Norton exclaimed.
That was when it started getting dark. But no, that's not exactly right. My thought at the time was not that it was getting dark, but that the lights in the market had gone out. I looked up at the fluorescence in a quick reflex action, and I wasn't alone. And at first, until I remembered the power failure, it seemed that was it. That was what had changed the quality of the light. Then I remembered they had been out all the time we had been in the market, and things hadn't seemed dark before. Then I knew, even before the people at the window started to yell and point, the mist was coming. It came from the Kansas Road entrance to the parking lot, and even this close it looked no different than it had when we first noticed it on the far side of the lake. It was white and bright, but non-reflecting. It was moving fast, and it had blotted out most of the sun. Where the sun had been, there was now a silver coin in the sky, like a full moon in winter seen through a thin scud of cloud. It came with lazy speed. Watching it reminded me somehow of last evening's waterspout. There are big forces in nature that you hardly ever see. Earthquakes, hurricanes, tornadoes. I haven't seen them all, but I've seen enough to guess that they all move with that lazy, hypnotizing speed. They hold you spellbound, the way Billy and Steffi had been in front of the picture window last night. It rolled impartially across the two-lane blacktop and erased it from view. The McKeon's nice, restored Dutch colonial was swallowed whole. For a moment, the second floor of the ramshackle apartment building next door jutted out of the whiteness, and then it went too. The keep right sign at the entrance and exit points to the Federal's parking lot disappeared, the black letters on the sign seeming to float for a moment in limbo after the sign's dirty white background was gone. The cars in the parking lot began to disappear next.
"What the Christ is this?" Norton asked again, and there was a catch in his voice.
It came on, eating up the blue sky and the fresh black hot top with equal ease. Even 20 feet away, the line of demarcation was perfectly clear. I had the nutty feeling that I was watching some extra good piece of visual effects, something dreamed up by Willis O'Brien or Douglas Trumbull. It happened so quickly. The blue sky disappeared to a wide swipe, then to a stripe, then to a pencil line. Then it was gone. Blank white pressed against the glass of the wide show window. I could see as far as the litter barrel that stood maybe 4 feet away, but not much farther. I could see the front bumper of my Scout, but that was all. A woman screamed, very loud and long. Billy pressed himself more tightly against me. His body was trembling like a loose bundle of wires with high voltage running through them. A man yelled and bolted through one of the deserted lanes toward the door. I think that was what finally started the stampede. People rushed pell-mell into the fog.
"Hey!"
Brown roared. I don't know if he was angry, scared, or both. His face was nearly purple. Veins stood out on his neck, looking almost as thick as battery cables.
"Hey, you people! You can't take that stuff! Get back here with that stuff! You're shoplifting!"
They kept going, but some of them tossed their stuff aside. Some were laughing and excited, but they were a minority. They poured out into the fog, and none of us who stayed ever saw them again. There was a faint, acrid smell drifting in through the open door. People began to jam up there. Some pushing and shoving started. I was getting an ache in my shoulders from holding Billy. He was good-sized. Steph sometimes called him her young heifer. Norton started to wander off, his face preoccupied and rather bemused. He was heading for the door. I switched Billy to the other arm so I could grab Norton's arm before he drifted out of reach. "No, man, I wouldn't," I said. He turned back.
"What?"
"Better wait and see."
"See what?"
"I don't know," I said.
"You don't think..."
he began, and a shriek came out of the fog. Norton shut up. The tight jam at the outdoor loosened and then reversed itself. The babble of excited conversation, shouts and calls subsided. The faces of the people by the door suddenly looked flat and pale and two-dimensional. The shriek went on and on, competing with the fire whistle. It seemed impossible that any human pair of lungs could have enough air in them to sustain such a shriek. Norton muttered, "Oh my God," and ran his hands through his hair. The shriek ended abruptly. It did not dwindle. It was cut off. One more man went outside, a beefy guy in chino work pants. I think he was set on rescuing the shrieker. For a moment he was out there, visible through the glass and the mist, like a figure seen through a milk scum on a tumbler. Then, and as far as I know, I was the only one to see this, something beyond him appeared to move, a gray shadow in all that white. And it seemed to me that instead of running into the fog, the man in the chino pants was jerked into it, his hands flailing upward as if in surprise. For a moment, there was total silence in the market. A constellation of moons suddenly glowed into being outside. The parking lot sodium lights, undoubtedly supplied by underground electrical cables, had just gone on.
"Don't go out there," Mrs. Carmody said in her best gore crow voice. "It's death to go out there."
All at once, no one seemed disposed to argue or laugh. Another scream came from outside, this one muffled and rather distant sounding. Billy tensed against me again.
"David, what's going on?"
Ollie Weeks asked. He had left his position. There were big beads of sweat on his round, smooth face.
"What is this?"
"I'll be goddamned if I have any idea," I said. Ollie looked badly scared. He was a bachelor who lived in a nice little house up by Highland Lake and who liked to drink in the bar at Pleasant Mountain. On the pudgy little finger of his left hand was a star sapphire ring. The February before, he won some money in the state lottery. He bought the ring out of his winnings. I always had the idea that Ollie was a little afraid of girls.
"I don't dig this," he said.
"No. Billy, I have to put you down. I'll hold your hand, but you're breaking my arms, okay?"
"Mommy,"
he whispered. "She's okay," I told him. It was something to say. The old geezer who runs the second-hand shop near John's restaurant walked past us, bundled into the old collegiate letter sweater he wears year-round. He said loudly,
"It's one of those pollution clouds. The mills at Rumford and South Paris. Chemicals."
With that, he made off up the aisle 4, past the patent, medicines, and toilet paper.
"Let's get out of here, David," Norton said with no conviction at all. "What do you say we..."
There was a thud, an odd twisting thud that I felt mostly in my feet, as if the entire building had suddenly dropped 3 feet. Several people cried out in fear and surprise. There was a musical jingle of bottles leaning off their shelves and destroying themselves upon the tile floor. A chunk of glass shaped like a pie wedge fell out of one of the segments of the wide front window, and I saw that the wooden frames banding the heavy sections of glass had buckled and splintered in some places. The fire whistle stopped in mid-whoop. The quiet that followed was the bated silence of people waiting for something else, something more. I was shocked and numb, and my mind made a strange cross-patch connection with the past. Back when Bridgeton was little more than a crossroads, my dad would take me in with him and stand talking at the counter while I looked through the glass at the penny candy and 2-cent chews. It was January thaw. No sound but the drip of meltwater falling from the galvanized tin gutters to the rain barrels on either side of the store. Me, looking at the jawbreakers and buttons and pinwheels. The mystic yellow globes of light overhead showing up the monstrous, projected shadows of last summer's battalion of dead flies. A little boy named David Drayton, with his father, the famous artist Andrew Drayton, whose painting, Christine Standing Alone, hung in the White House. A little boy named David Drayton, looking at the candy and the Davy Crockett bubblegum cards, and vaguely needing to go pee. And outside, the pressing, billowing yellow fog of January thaw. The memory passed, but very slowly.
"You people," Norton bellowed. "All you people, listen to me."
They looked around. Norton was holding up both hands, the fingers splayed like a political candidate accepting accolades.
"It may be dangerous to go outside," Norton yelled.
"Why?"
a woman screamed back.
"My kids are at home. I got to get back to my kids."
"It's death to go out there,"
Mrs. Carmody came back smartly. She was standing by the 25-pound sacks of fertilizer stacked below the window, and her face seemed to bulge somehow, as if she were swelling. A teenager gave her a sudden hard push, and she sat down on the bags with a surprised grunt.
"Stop saying that, you old bag! Stop rapping that crazy bullshit!"
"Please," Norton yelled. "If we wait just a few moments until it blows over and we can see..."
A babble of conflicting shouts greeted this. "He's right," I said, shouting to be heard over the noise. "Let's just try to keep cool."
"I think that was an earthquake," a bespectacled man said. His voice was soft. In one hand, he held a package of hamburger and a bag of buns. The other hand was holding the hand of a little girl, maybe a year younger than Billy.
"I really think that was an earthquake."
"They had one over in Naples 4 years ago," a fat local man said.
"That was in Casco," his wife contradicted immediately. She spoke in the unmistakable tones of a veteran contradictor.
"Naples," the fat local man said, but with less assurance.
"Casco," his wife said firmly, and he gave up.
Somewhere, a can that had been jostled to the very edge of its shelf by the thump, earthquake, whatever it had been, fell off with a delayed clatter.
Billy burst into tears.
"I want to go home. I want my mother."
"Can't you shut that kid up?" Bud Brown asked. His eyes were darting rapidly but aimlessly from place to place.
"Would you like a shot in the teeth, Motormouth?" I asked him.
"Come on, Dave. That's not helping," Norton said distractedly.
"I'm sorry,"
the woman who had screamed earlier said.
"I'm sorry, but I can't stay here. I've got to get home and see to my kids."
She looked around at us. A blonde woman with a tired, pretty face.
"Wanda's looking after little Victor, you see. Wanda's only 8, and sometimes she forgets she's supposed to be, well, watching him, you know. And little Victor, he likes to turn on the stove burners to see the little red light come on. He likes that light, and sometimes he pulls out the plugs. Little Victor does, and Wanda gets bored watching him after a while. She's just 8.
She stopped talking and just looked at us. I imagined that we must have looked like nothing but a bank of merciless eyes to her right then. Not human beings at all, just eyes.
"Isn't anyone going to help me?"
she screamed. Her lips began to tremble.
Won't anybody here see a lady home?"
No one replied. People shuffled their feet. She looked from face to face with her own broken face. The fat local man took a hesitant half-step forward, and his wife jerked him back with one quick tug, her hand clapped over his wrist like a manacle.
You?
The blonde woman asked Ollie. He shook his head.
You?
She said to Bud. He put his hand over the Texas Instruments calculator on the counter and made no reply.
You?
She said to Norton. And Norton began to say something in his big lawyer's voice, something about how no one should go off half-cocked, and she dismissed him, and Norton just trailed off.
You?
She said to me, and I picked Billy up again and held him in my arms like a shield to ward off her terrible broken face.
I hope you all rot in hell,
she said. She didn't scream it. Her voice was dead tired. She went to the outdoor and pulled it open using both hands. I wanted to say something to her, call her back, but my mouth was too dry.
Oh, lady, listen,
the teenage kid who had shouted at Mrs. Carmody began. He held her arm. She looked down at his hand and he let her go, shame-faced. She slipped out into the fog. We watched her go, and no one said anything. We watched the fog overlay her and make her insubstantial, not a human being anymore, but a pencil-ink sketch of a human being done on the world's whitest paper, and no one said anything. For a moment, it was like the letters of the Keep Right sign that had seemed to float on nothingness. Her arms and legs and pallid blonde hair were all gone, and only the misty remnants of her red summer dress remained, seeming to dance in white limbo. Then her dress was gone, too, and no one said anything. 4. The storage area. Problems with the generators. What happened to the bag boy? Billy began to act hysterical and tantrumy, screaming for his mother in a hoarse, demanding way through his tears, instantly regressing to the age of 2. Snot was lathered on his upper lip. I led him away, walking down one of the middle aisles with my arm around his shoulders, trying to soothe him. I took him by the long weight meat cabinet that ran the length of the store at the back. Mr. McVeigh, the butcher, was still there. We nodded at each other, the best we could do under the circumstances. I sat down on the floor and took Billy on my lap and held his face against my chest and rocked him and talked to him. I told him all the lies parents keep in reserve for bad situations, the ones that sound so damn plausible to a child, and I told them in a tone of perfect conviction.
That's not regular fog,
Billy said. He looked up at me, his eyes dark-circled and tear-streaked.
It isn't, is it, Daddy?
No, I don't think so. I didn't want to lie about that.
Kids don't fight shock the way adults do. They go with it. Maybe because kids are in a semi-permanent state of shock until they're 13 or so.
Billy started to doze off. I held him, thinking he might snap awake again, but his doze deepened into a real sleep. Maybe he had been awake part of the night before when we had slept 3 in a bed for the first time since Billy was an infant. And maybe, I felt a cold eddy slip through me at the thought, maybe he had sensed something coming. When I was sure he was solidly out, I laid him on the floor and went looking for something to cover him up with. Most of the people were still up front looking out into the thick blanket of mist. Norton had gathered a little crowd of listeners and was busy spellbinding, or trying to. Bud Brown stood rigidly at his post, but Ollie Weeks had left his. There were a few people in the aisles, wandering like ghosts, their faces greasy with shock. I went into the storage area through the big double doors between the meat cabinet and the beer cooler. The generator roared steadily behind its plywood partition, but something had gone wrong. I could smell diesel fumes, and they were much too strong. I walked toward the partition, taking shallow breaths. At last, I unbuttoned my shirt and put part of it over my mouth and nose. The storage area was long and narrow, feebly lit by 2 sets of emergency lights. Cartons were stacked everywhere. Bleach on one side, cases of soft drinks on the far side of the partition, stacked cases of beefaroni and ketchup. One of those had fallen over and the cardboard carton appeared to be bleeding. I unlatched the door in the generator partition and stepped through. The machine was obscured in drifting oily clouds of blue smoke. The exhaust pipe ran out through a hole in the wall. Something must have blocked off the outside end of the pipe. There was a simple on-off switch, and I flipped it. The generator hitched, belched, coughed, and died. Then it ran down in a diminishing series of popping sounds that reminded me of Norton's stubborn chainsaw. The emergency lights faded out, and I was left in darkness. I got scared very quickly, and I got disoriented. My breathing sounded like a low wind, rattling in straw. I bumped my nose on the flimsy plywood door going out, and my heart lurched. There were windows in the double doors, but for some reason they had been painted black, and the darkness was nearly total. I got off course and ran into a stack of the bleach cartons. They tumbled and fell. One came close enough to my head to make me step backward, and I tripped over another carton that had landed behind me. I fell down, thumping my head hard enough to see bright stars in the darkness. Good show. I lay there cursing myself and rubbing my head, telling myself to just take it easy. Just get up and get out of here. Get back to Billy, telling myself nothing soft and slimy was going to close over my ankle or slip into one groping hand. I told myself not to lose control, or I would end up blundering around back here in a panic, knocking things over and creating a mad obstacle course for myself. I stood up carefully, looking for a pencil line of light between the double doors. I found it, a faint but unmistakable scratch on the darkness. I started toward it, and then stopped. There was a sound. A soft, sliding sound. It stopped, then started again with a stealthy little bump. Everything inside me went loose. I regressed, magically, to 4 years of age. That sound wasn't coming from the market. It was coming from behind me. From outside, where the mist was. Something that was slipping and sliding and scraping over the cinder blocks. And maybe looking for a way in. Or maybe it was already in, and it was looking for me. Maybe in a moment I would feel whatever was making that sound on my shoe or on my neck. It came again. I was positive it was outside. But that didn't make it any better. I told my legs to go, and they refused the order. Then the quality of the noise changed. Something rasped across the darkness, and my heart leaped in my chest, and I lunged at that thin vertical line of light. I hit the door's straight arm and burst through into the market. Three or four people were right outside the double doors. Ollie Weeks was one of them, and they all jumped back in surprise. Ollie grabbed at his chest. "David," he said in a pinched voice. "Jesus Christ, you want to take 10 years off my..." He saw my face. "What's the matter with you?"
"Did you hear it?"
I asked. My voice sounded strange in my own ears, high and squeaking.
"Did any of you hear it?"
They hadn't heard anything, of course. They had come up to see why the generator had gone off. As Ollie told me that, one of the bag boys bustled up with an armload of flashlights. He looked from Ollie to me curiously. "I turned the generator off," I said, and explained why.
"What did you hear?" one of the other men asked. He worked for the town road department. His name was Jim something.
"I don't know. A scraping noise. Slithery. I don't want to hear it again."
"Nerves," the other fellow with Ollie said.
No, it was not nerves.
"Did you hear it before the lights went out?"
"No, only after. But nothing." I could see the way they were looking at me. They didn't want any more bad news, anything else frightening or off-kilter. There was enough of that already. Only Ollie looked as if he believed me.
"Let's go in and start her up again," the bag boy said, handing out the flashlights.
Ollie took his doubtfully. The bag boy offered me one, a slightly contemptuous shine in his eyes. He was maybe 18. After a moment's thought, I took the light. I still needed something to cover Billy with. Ollie opened the doors and chocked them, letting in some light. The bleach cartons lay scattered around the half-open door in the plywood partition. The fella named Jim sniffed and said,
"Smells pretty rank, all right. Guess you was right to shut it down."
The flashlight beams bobbed and danced across cartons of canned goods, toilet paper, dog food. The beams were smoky, and the drifting fumes the blocked exhaust had turned back into the storage area. The bag boy trained his light briefly on the wide loading door at the extreme right. The two men and Ollie went inside the generator compartment. Their lights flashed uneasily back and forth, reminding me of something out of a boy's adventure story, and I illustrated a series of them while I was still in college. Pirates burying their bloody gold at midnight, or maybe the mad doctor and his assistant snatching a body. Shadows, made twisted and monstrous by the shifting, conflicting flashlight beams, bobbed on the walls. The generator ticked irregularly as it cooled. The bag boy was walking toward the loading door, flashing his light ahead of him. "I wouldn't go over there," I said.
"No, I know you wouldn't."
"Try it now, Ollie,"
one of the men said. The generator wheezed, then roared.
"Jesus, shut it down! Holy crow, don't that stink!"
The generator died again. The bag boy walked back from the loading door just as they came out.
"Something's plugged that exhaust, all right,"
one of the men said. "I'll tell you what," the bag boy said. His eyes were shining in the glow of the flashlights, and there was a devil-may-care expression on his face that I had sketched too many times as part of the frontispieces for my boy's adventure series.
"Get it running long enough for me to raise the loading door back there. I'll go around and clear away whatever it is."
"Norm, I don't think that's a very good idea," Ollie said doubtfully.
"Is it an electric door?"
the one called Jim asked.
"Sure," Ollie said, "but I just don't think it would be wise for..."
"That's okay,"
the other guy said. He tipped his baseball cap back on his head.
"I'll do it."
"No, you don't understand," Ollie began again. "I really don't think anyone should..."
"Don't worry,"
he said indulgently to Ollie, dismissing him. Norm, the bag boy, was indignant.
"Listen, it was my idea," he said.
All at once, by some magic, they had gotten around to arguing about who was going to do it instead of whether or not it should be done at all. But of course, none of them had heard that nasty, slithering sound.
"Stop it," I said loudly.
They looked around at me.
"You don't seem to understand, or you're trying as hard as you can not to understand. This is no ordinary fog. Nobody has come into the market since it hit. If you open that loading door and something comes in..."
"Something like what?"
Norm said with perfect 18-year-old macho contempt.
"Whatever made the noise I heard." "Mr. Drayton," Jim said, "pardon me, but I'm not convinced you heard anything. I know you're a big-shot artist with connections in New York and Hollywood and all, but that doesn't make you any different from anyone else in my book. Way I figure, you got in here in the dark, and maybe you just got a little confused."
"Maybe I did," I said, "and maybe if you want to start screwing around outside, you ought to start by making sure that lady got home safe to her kids." His attitude, and that of his buddy and of Norm the bag boy, was making me mad and scaring me more at the same time. They had the sort of light in their eyes that some men get when they go shooting rats at the town dump.
"Hey," Jim's buddy said, "when any of us here wants your advice, we'll ask for it."
Hesitantly, Ollie said,
"The generator really isn't that important, you know. The food in the cold cases will keep for 12 hours or more with absolutely no..."
"Okay, kid, you're it," Jim said brusquely. "I'll start the motor. You raise the door so that the place doesn't stink up too bad. Me and Myron will be standing by the exhaust outflow. Give us a yell when it's clear."
"Sure," Norm said, and bustled excitedly away. "This is crazy," I said. "You let that lady go by herself."
"I didn't notice you breaking your ass to escort her,"
Jim's buddy Myron said. A dull, brick-colored flush was creeping out of his collar. "But you're gonna let this kid risk his life over a generator that doesn't even matter?"
"Why don't you just shut the fuck up?"
Norm yelled.
"Listen, Mr. Drayton," Jim said and smiled at me coldly. "I'll tell you what. If you've got anything else to say, I think you better count your teeth first, because I'm tired of listening to your bullshit."
Ollie looked at me, plainly frightened. I shrugged. They were crazy. That was all. Their sense of proportion was temporarily gone. Out there, they had been confused and scared, and here was a straightforward mechanical problem, a balky generator. It was possible to solve this problem. Solving the problem would help make them feel less confused and helpless. Therefore, they would solve it.
Jim and his friend Myron decided I knew when I was licked and went back into the generator compartment.
"Ready, Norm?"
Jim asked.
Norm nodded, then realized they couldn't hear a nod.
"Yeah,"
he said. "Norm," I said, "don't be a fool."
"It's a mistake," Ollie added. He looked at us, and suddenly his face was much younger than 18. It was the face of a boy. His Adam's apple bobbed convulsively, and I saw that he was scared green. He opened his mouth to say something. I think he was going to call it off, and then the generator roared into life again, and when it was running smoothly, Norm lunged at the button to the right of the door, and it began to rattle upward on its jewel steel tracks. The emergency lights had come back on when the generator started. Now they dimmed down as the motor which lifted the door sucked away the juice. The shadows ran backward and melted. The storage area began to fill with the mellow white light of an overcast late winter day. I noticed that odd, acrid smell again. The loading door went up 2 feet, then 4. Beyond, I could see a square cement platform outlined around the edges with a yellow stripe. The yellow faded and washed out in just 3 feet.
The fog was incredibly thick.
"Ho up!" Norm yelled.
Tendrils of mist, as white and fine as floating lace, eddied inside. The air was cold. It had been noticeably cool all morning long, especially after the sticky heat of the last 3 weeks, but it had been a summery coolness. This was cold. It was like March. I shivered, and I thought of Steph. The generator died. Jim came out just as Norm ducked under the door. He saw it. So did I. So did Ollie. A tentacle came over the far lip of the concrete loading platform and grabbed Norm around the calf. My mouth dropped wide open. Ollie made a very short glottal sound of surprise.
Ugh!
The tentacle tapered from a thickness of a foot, the size of a grass snake, at the point where it had wrapped itself around Norm's lower leg to a thickness of maybe 4 or 5 feet where it disappeared into the mist. It was slate gray on top, shading to a fleshy pink underneath, and there were rows of suckers on the underside. They were moving and writhing like hundreds of small puckering mouths. Norm looked down. He saw what had him. His eyes bulged.
"Get it off me! Hey, get it off me! Christ Jesus, get this friggin' thing off me!"
"Oh my God,"
Jim whimpered.
Norm grabbed the bottom edge of the loading door and yanked himself back in. The tentacle seemed to bulge, the way your arm will when you flex it. Norm was yanked back against the corrugated steel door. His head clanged against it. The tentacle bulged more, and Norm's legs and torso began to slip back out. The bottom edge of the loading door scraped the shirt tail out of his pants. He yanked savagely and pulled himself back in like a man doing a chin-up.
"Help me," he was sobbing. "Help me, you guys. Please, please."
"Jesus, Mary, and Joseph,"
Myron said. He had come out of the generator compartment to see what was going on. I was the closest, and I grabbed Norm around the waist and yanked as hard as I could, rocking back on my heels. For a moment we moved backward, but only for a moment. It was like stretching a rubber band or pulling taffy. The tentacle yielded, but gave up its basic grip, not at all. Then 3 more tentacles floated out of the mist toward us. One curled around Norm's flapping red federal apron and tore it away. It disappeared back into the mist with the red cloth curled in its grip, and I thought of something my mother used to say when my brother and I would beg for something she didn't want us to have. Candy, a comic book, some toy.
"You need that like a hen needs a flag," she'd say.
I thought of that, and I thought of that tentacle waving Norm's red apron around, and I got laughing. I got laughing. Except my laughter and Norm's scream sounded about the same. Maybe no one even knew I was laughing except me. The other two tentacles slithered aimlessly back and forth on the loading platform for a moment, making those low scraping sounds I had heard earlier. Then one of them slapped against Norm's left hip and slipped around it. I felt it touch my arm. It was warm and pulsing and smooth. I think now that if it had gripped me with those suckers, I would have gone out into the mist too. But it didn't. It grabbed Norm, and the third tentacle ringleted his other ankle. Now he was being pulled away from me.
"Help me!" I shouted. "Ollie, someone, give me a hand here!"
But they didn't come. I don't know what they were doing, but they didn't come. I looked down and saw the tentacle around Norm's waist working into his skin. The suckers were eating him where his shirt had pulled out of his pants. Blood, as red as his missing apron, began to seep out of the trench the pulsing tentacle had made for itself. I banged my head on the lower edge of the partly raised door. Norm's legs were outside again. One of his loafers had fallen off. A new tentacle came out of the mist, wrapped its tip firmly around the shoe, and made off with it. Norm's fingers clutched at the door's lower edge. He had it in a death grip. His fingers were livid. He was not screaming anymore. He was beyond that. His head whipped back and forth in an endless gesture of negation, and his long black hair flew wildly. I looked over his shoulder and saw more tentacles coming. Dozens of them, a forest of them. Most were small, but a few were gigantic, as thick as the moss-corseted tree that had been lying across our driveway that morning. The big ones had candy-pink suckers that seemed the size of manhole covers. One of these big ones struck the concrete loading platform with a loud and rolling thrap sound and moved sluggishly toward us like a great blind earthworm. I gave one gigantic tug, and the tentacle holding Norm's right calf slipped a little. That was all. But before it reestablished its grip, I saw that the thing was eating him away. One of the tentacles brushed delicately past my cheek and then wavered in the air, as if debating. I thought of Billy then. Billy was lying asleep in the market by Mr. McVeigh's long white meat cooler. I had come in here to find something to cover him up with. If one of those things got hold of me, there would be no one to watch out for him, except maybe Norton. So I let go of Norm and dropped to my hands and knees. I was half in and half out, directly under the raised door. A tentacle passed by on my left, seeming to walk on its suckers. It attached itself to one of Norm's bulging upper arms, paused for a second, and then slid around it in coils. Now Norm looked like something out of a madman's dream of snake charming. Tentacles twisted over him uneasily almost everywhere, and they were all around me as well. I made a clumsy leapfrog jump back inside, landed on my shoulder, and rolled. Jim, Ollie, and Myron were still there. They stood like a tableau of waxworks in Madame Tussauds, their faces pale, their eyes too bright. Jim and Myron flanked the door to the generator compartment.
"Start the generator!"
I yelled at them. Neither moved. They were staring with a drugged, thanatotic avidity at the loading bay. I groped on the floor, picked up the first thing that came to hand, a box of snowy bleach, and chucked it at Jim. It hit him in the gut just above the belt buckle. He grunted and grabbed at himself. His eyes flickered back into some semblance of normality.
"Go start that fucking generator!"
I screamed so loudly it hurt my throat. He didn't move. Instead, he began to defend himself, apparently having decided that, with Norm being eaten alive by some insane horror from the mist, the time had come for rebuttals.
"I'm sorry," he whined. "I didn't know. How the hell was I supposed to know? You said you heard something, but I didn't know what you meant. You should have said what you meant better. I thought, I don't know, maybe a bird or something."
So then Ollie moved, bunting him aside with one thick shoulder and blundering into the generator room. Jim stumbled over one of the bleach cartons and fell down, just as I had done in the dark.
"I'm sorry,"
he said again. His red hair had tumbled over his brow. His cheeks were cheese white. His eyes were those of a horrified little boy.
Seconds later, the generator coughed and rumbled into life. I turned back to the loading door. Norm was almost gone, yet he clung grimly with one hand. His body boiled with tentacles, and the blood pattered serenely down.